of us yearns for unity and meaning and justice. We want to connect to our life, to touch the wonder at its roots.
Schooling indoctrinates youngsters into the world without challenging it, without imagining alternatives. It's a claustrophobic, cramped place to be in, and with every new initiative getting further mired in different dead ends.
And to live in a world that is not governed by petty tyrants, be they people or systems. When it is not there, we can sense its absence.
Meanwhile, in the real world, our education fails to be a civilizing force.
Hi, I'm the author of Against Capitalist Education, published by Zero Books, and this is the Against Capitalist Education podcast. Elaine Graham Lee is a member of Counterfire and a former member of the steering committee of the Campaign Against Climate Change. She has been speaking on climate change for more than a decade, at events ranging from small public meetings to national demonstrations. She has written widely on this and other political issues, particularly for Counterfire, and has had articles republished by New Internationalist and also in the Handbook of the Climate Movement. This is the second part of a longer conversation.
But they don't strike me. Cameron never struck me like that. George Osborne never struck me that they ever had any issue with finance at all. So have we almost gone back to a model and a world which is more, is closer to the turn of the previous century than the kind of progressive levelling out, kind of breaking down this hierarchy of, you know, money, culture and all this, this kind of model? It's quite disturbing, I find.
I think we have. I think there was a period there with sort of the baby boom generation actually people could come from very ordinary, very working class backgrounds and have a chance of getting into creative professions, have a chance of becoming, you know, actors or writers or, you know, obviously they had to be lucky and they had to have talent and so on, but there was kind of an opening there where you could do that. And it now feels like all sorts of things, which aren't necessarily particularly glamorous, you can only get into if basically you've got a trust fund. So that you can live off that for years while you're making your way in that profession. And if you have to earn a living, well, no, sorry, that's closed to you. My background originally is in medieval history. It did actually really become the case that you had to have private money to be able to hang around and get the little bits of teaching for years and years that you needed before you could break into it. If you actually had to pay the rent, that was, you know, unless you got very lucky, you were shut out.
It's actually really, really disturbing. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I do think about... I mean, in my own case, a very, very similar kind of trajectory. But actually, I deliberately sidestepped the system and then went off and just did lots of different jobs. And pursued an ambition, I think, which I think no one would understand, so I didn't worry about trying to stay in a comfortable environment, i.e. at university, and pursue physics through to wherever it would have led. But it just strikes me that that's an exception, that's a bit eccentric in that way, but it just strikes me that we have become, you know, we get Boris Johnson is the mayor of London and people are happy to vote for him. We get even the new guy, Sadiq Khan, who strikes me as that he's a Tony Blairite. He has that very kind of big business is good, the system is basically right. And I'm just going to put a brown face to basically a policy which, you know, and make it seem more acceptable. Didn't I read somewhere, maybe out of Verso book somewhere, that under Obama's regime, more drone attacks have gone on. Guantanamo Bay hasn't, all kinds of terrible things. I know Obamacare is seen as a big step forward. I'm not denying that. But it just seems to me that we you know, the system itself is turned into an almost, who is in control of it? Obviously, they're an elite who parasite and feed off it, right? And you're right, they don't sit around in rooms smoking and constructing the world, though if you ever watch that TV series,
there was a period there with sort of the baby boom generation,
yeah,
where
yeah.
actually people could come from very ordinary, very working class backgrounds and have a chance of getting into creative professions, have a chance of becoming, you know, actors or writers or, you know, obviously they had to be lucky and they had to have talent and so on, but there was kind of an opening there where you could do that, and it now feels like all sorts of things, which aren't necessarily particularly glamorous, you can only get into if basically you've got a trust fund, so that you can live off that for years while you're making your way in that profession, and if you have to earn a living, well, no, sorry, that's closed to you.
The one with the hacker, the computer hacker, I forget the name of it.
Oh, yes. I haven't seen it, but I've seen trailers for it. I know exactly the one you mean.
Yeah, it's premised on the fact that the whole system is about there's a group of people sitting in the darkened room, smoking, concocting the world.
Mm.
It's a nice fantasy, but actually the system itself seems to have a generator and a motor of its own. There seems almost, this is the thing that people say, that it's almost impossible to break. So we look at the, we go back, let's go back to the food thing, because food, biology seem really fundamental things about, you know, eating, consuming, and you have to eat to survive, but you can then eat in surplus, and everyone does eat in surplus and all the rest of it. But how they've become demonized, tell me more about the this argument, a link to climate change. Has the argument worked other than making people feel guilty, and in the end they've stopped feeling guilty and they think, stuff it, I'm still going to eat my McDonald's or whatever, I'm going to leave an whatever kind of lifestyle I want. I mean, I assume you don't mean, if you have an unhealthy lifestyle, stuff it, just carry on. You mean, don't demonise someone who does that in a political context.
Yes. I mean, what I'm saying is that it's not helpful for any sort of movements that's looking at, well, why is climate change happening and how can we stop it, to say that actually the focus of this should be hectoring working class people about what they're eating, which is where the food arguments lead you.
Yes.
And I think the reason why they do is because they're coming from that sense that, okay, we've got a finite planet that's got a certain carrying capacity, even though actually we can't really calculate what that carrying capacity is. No. I mean, people have tried, but it's, you know, I haven't seen anything that's very convincing there. My background originally is in medieval history. Did actually really become the case that you had to have private money to be able to hang around and get the little bits of teaching for years and years that you needed before you could break into it. If you actually had to pay the rent, that was, you know, unless you got very lucky, you were shut out. What I'm saying is that it's not helpful for any sort of movements that's looking at, well, why is climate change happening and how can we stop it, to say that actually the focus of this should be hectoring working class people about what they're eating. But we know that it's finite, so therefore we've got a small cake that we've got to divide up. And that's where, okay, some people have to sacrifice, so that's where you start demonising the people who are asking to sacrifice, and so on and so on. Whereas what I'm arguing is that is a completely unhelpful way of conceptualising the issues that we face. And actually, it's not that the numbers of humans or the numbers of working class humans or the appetites of working class humans don't fit on the planet, it's that capitalism doesn't fit on the planet. Okay. And actually, if you understand this as a problem of the system, then that tells that not only is a kind of an intellectual thing where it shows you what attitude you should have to your working class neighbours, it actually tells you, well, where do you point your movement? Where do you, if you understand that it's a system that's the problem, then maybe what you need to be doing is thinking about, well, where are the weak points in the system? Whereas if you think that it's working class people don't care about climate change is the problem, then obviously that would lead you to a very different conclusion for what you should do in campaigning terms.
No, absolutely. And then actually, I mean, I see a lot of the tactics of media in this context, and listening to what you're saying, as deflection and not obfuscation, but there is a very clever mechanism of making an issue out of something which really ought to just not be there. I mean, I personally found the whole referendum a complete and utter waste of time, and I wish it never happened, because it just struck me that, you know, there are flaws in Europe, there are flaws in the government systems here, but by being preoccupied by referenda, be out, be in the end, you're just tweaking stuff systems that might be flawed there, here, you know, democracy, for example. How is our parliamentary system, you know, so perfect and Europe so flawed? How is Europe better? All these questions that don't go away, and it turns into a nice, pointless kind of sideshow. Whereas I would wish that somehow we could stop that noise, eliminate some of that noise that turns out, and start looking at these type of questions. So, you know, you raise the fundamental question about capitalism, and a lot of people would just say, oh, I'm too tired, I haven't got the, you know, I can't understand the system, it's so complicated. But I think the point is that perhaps we just don't try collectively. We, you know, I think of David Harvey's lectures on capitalism, on Marxism, Volume 1 and 2. It would be wonderful to see that as part of a curriculum at school. Because it would be quite a shock to kids as they develop a political consciousness to think there's actually some kind of linkage between economics and politics, control and the rest of it.
Sacrifice and so on and so on. Whereas what I'm arguing is that that is a completely unhelpful way of conceptualising the issues that we face. And actually, what it's not that the numbers of humans or the numbers of working class humans or the appetites of working class humans don't fit on the planet, it's that capitalism doesn't fit on the planet. Okay. And actually, if you understand this as a problem of the system, then that tells that not only is a kind of an intellectual thing where it shows you what attitude you should have to your working class neighbours, it actually tells you, well, where do you point your movement? Where do you, if you understand that it's the system that's the problem, then maybe what you need to be doing is thinking about, well, where are the weak points in the system? Whereas if you think that it's working class people don't care about climate change is the problem.
You can't just, as a, you know, wanting your mobile phone isn't just a naive act of desiring an object. You know, it's woven into this huge network of relations. And it, I find it depresses me enormously. How on earth do we find a path out of it? What's your view about, okay, so we look at this, we see that food is a distraction, we see the system is the flawed at the heart of it, that it's not, and I like the way you say it, it's not right for the planet, because climate, the damage, the danger is that it just keeps on carrying on in this kind of, it's like a gigantic eating machine, isn't it, a destroying machine. What kind of approaches would you say are more constructive approaches rather than these pointless deflections? Do you have a feeling about that? You know, if people did more of this or spent more time thinking about this or presenting this, joining that, what's your feeling about that side of it?
Well, I think in terms of kind of thinking about practically how we campaign on these issues, it's really the conclusion that I was coming to was that climate change is such an abstraction, and actually it covers so many different areas of activity and so many different facets of how capitalism works, that in a way it's not always all that helpful to campaign on it as a kind of a discrete issue.
Oh, I see.
Spend really quite a lot of time sort of trying to build a kind of a mass movement on sort of climate change. And in a sense, I mean, obviously, we know we had some big demos, and, you know, it's not like it was a failure or anything. But in a way, it was sort of oddly hard, and I think that's part of the problem. And I think what I was trying to argue in the book was seeing this, you know, the food issue as this kind of attack on working class people, as actually part of the development of the whole austerity agenda, and and concluding that actually, well, the way to actually, you know, the place that the system is weak at the moment, the kind of the weak link in the chain, in a sense, is actually on austerity. And what you need to do is, rather than having kind of a completely separate campaign on climate change, which is going on at the same time as the anti-austerity campaigning, what you need to do is put climate change in the anti-austerity campaigning.
Okay.
And make that really consciously, and also climate change is an issue of austerity. Also, we need public money being put into alternatives to fossil fuel, and so on and so on. And actually, if you make that part of that, then you're hitting capitalism actually where the system at the moment is vulnerable, rather than kind of trying to do this other thing which actually isn't necessarily working all that well. So And actually, I think, you know, the anti-austerity movement has been quite successful. I mean, after all, the if you think about where we were in kind of maybe 2009, 2010, where everyone was saying, oh, well, we have to balance the books, you know, you can't overspend and so on. And now, you know, you have, you know, Owen Smith was being more anti-austerity. Even Theresa May has said some anti-austerity things. It kind of feels like actually we've kind of won the argument on that one.
That's really, really interesting. I want to draw into that a little bit more. I have friends who been involved in various projects, and I like the idea. I think I detect from what you say that a good way of tackling it in a constructive way is you invest in.
Well, I think in terms of kind of thinking about practically how we, you know, how we campaign on these issues, it's really the conclusion that I was coming to was that climate change is such an abstraction, and actually it covers so many different areas of activity and so many different facets of how capitalism works, that in a way it's not always all that helpful to campaign on it as a kind of a discrete issue.
Oh,
I see. Spend really quite a lot of time sort of trying to build a kind of a mass movement on sort of climate change, and in a sense. I mean, obviously, we know he had some big demos, and, you know, it's not like it was a failure or anything. But in a way, it was sort of oddly hard, and I think that's part of the problem. And I think what
both labour, time, effort, because you're generating jobs, you're generating constructive, productive economic activity in things like energy systems, alternative energy systems. Friends of mine who live in Ham in Richmond have been involved for a very long time in a project. They cycled to Paris. He cycled to Paris as well for the summit talks. The challenges he has faced, I mean, I'm trying to encourage him to write about it, because I think I agree with you that, for me, if I were to kind of do the David Harvey, where he once in one lecture said these are five things that need to change, or six things simultaneously, and we need to work at them simultaneously rather than one or the other. Mm. When I think after a lecture by Zizek, who said Viva la Revolution, and everyone had a great time watching films and stuff. Although I like Zizek, I don't think Zizek, unlike someone like David Harvey, seems to have thought through how you can. Maybe that's unfair, and all the Zizek fans out there, I know Doug Lane's a Zizek fan, I'm not so keen on that. I like the idea that you have local projects, local environmental projects, as you say, working on those alternative energy sources, so you can scale them up, you can look at them as pilot projects scattered around wherever they are, small-scale community-based projects. But you also look at the intellectual foundations of it, you look at the education system and how, you know, and it's Althusser who called them ideological state apparatus, which is quite a scary statement, that you know, education is that indoctrinates. You think, it's not doing it explicitly, it's doing it in such a devious way, and having young children, listening to the how the system works, it excludes debate at crucial points. And really the education system needs to have those points full of debate and full of discussion, and political education needs to be in our school system, I think, fundamentally. And it seems that there's a kind of multi-pronged, multi-levelled approach to this whole thing, if we are really serious about the fact that capitalism... I mean, would you say that's fair, or would you say that that denies the Marxist, the revolutionary spirit, or is that a little bit too slow in your view?
Well, I think, I mean, I am a revolutionary.
Okay.
But I think the problem with the sort of the Zizek approach, as you sort of characterise it, and I don't have an awful lot of time for Zizek either, is that it's not enough to just plant your flag and say Viva the Revolution. You know, you have to understand, well, how are you going to get there? It's not like the slumbering mass of the proletariat are just going to wake up and say, oh, you're talking about revolution, oh, right, we'll get on that.
Yeah.
That's not how it works. And you can't, while you're waiting for your perfect revolutionary moment to happen, you can't just sit around telling everyone else why they're wrong. You know, you do have to. have to fight for reforms now, and something like climate change.
Yeah.
You know, it is actually, although the basic problem is the capitalist system, so to really solve our ecological problems, you need to overthrow the capitalist system. But you could tomorrow start creating a green electricity infrastructure. You know, we have the technology right now. You could decide that you're actually going to put government money into this. You're not going to renew Trident. You're going to spend all that money on creating renewable energy. And you could actually power the entire country from renewable energy if you just decided to do it. And they could start doing it tomorrow. I'd like if they wanted to. Yeah, so you don't have to have the revolution to make that happen. So that's a reform that you can fight for right now.
Absolutely. In fact, and I do apologise. I have this horrible style of keeping interrupting. But I just want to pick up that idea, that very, very model. It just strikes me as someone once said to me, "Well, that's how ridiculous." A conservative with a small C friend said to me, "Oh, it's ridiculous because alternative energy will never generate the power that a nuclear power station could, or this or that or that. It's noisy, blah, blah, blah." And I think, have you ever thought that the combustion engine, which drives the 200 years ago, didn't exist, and it was an engineering feat. It was a bit of maths, a bit of engineering, and a bit of intellectual effort which brought it into existence.
In your views?
Well, I am a revolutionary.
Okay.
But I think the problem with the sort of the Žižek approach, as you sort of characterise it, and I don't have an awful lot of time for Žižek either, is that it's not enough to just plant your flag and say, "Viva the revolution." You know, you have to understand, well, how are you going to get there? It's not like the slumbering mass of the proletariat are just going to wake up and say, "Oh, you're talking about revolution. Oh, right, we'll get on that."
Yeah.
That's not how it works. And you can't, while you're waiting for your perfect revolutionary moment to happen, you can't just sit around telling everyone else why they're wrong.
Why do you believe that humanity lacks the capacity to find that same kind of skill and apply it to different configuration of raw materials, you know, different mathematics, the engineering? I agree. I mean, I like the fact that universities are teaching sustainable and they're asking for engineers to join them. So I trained an access student to go and study, and he had to have maths. And I liked it because they wanted an engineer. They didn't want someone just to say, "This is a nice thing," and we can. They wanted someone who could actually build something, constructively build it. So I entirely agree. Okay, so here's the scary thing. Friends of mine are now worried that if Trump ever got in, God forbid, he would cancel every kind of accord to do with renewable energy. I read somewhere that Theresa May closed down a department which was funding green energy and green technology, and that she's very, very dismissive of it. I'm not sure how accurate that is.
Yes, it's now part of the business department or something like that. I know they've kind of organised the sort of the environment department out of existence. I can't remember now what it's called, but that was a big thing.
Why do they do? I mean, it's crazy and maybe a stupid question to ask, but why do they do it when? We're not, you know, once we look at these issues here, I mean, Marx in the end was maybe a utopian, he believed in a better humanity. And his diagnosis of the working class versus the bourgeoisie, you know, crudely, was you don't think this is actually going on, it's like psychoanalysis. You don't think these are problems, actually they are. I'm going to draw them to the surface and show them to you. And if you're going to change the system, you've got to look at these factors as well. Don't dismiss economics and have your fancy little revolution without it. In psychoanalysis, don't think about the way that psychology invests in a kind of the world systems that we have, and so on, in the way that Jacques Lacan has. Why would someone in the government who has no, on the surface of it, no reason not to say this is a good thing for us as a species? I mean, species thinking, crudely put. Am I just so completely naive that they are still locked into very, very cliched and power elites and serving power elites, and in the background some small lobby group has said to them? Is that just the reality that we have in our system?
There's kind of multi levels to the answer to that.
If you went to did you go to that talk? The invitation that you sent me, there was a talk about the Labour Party, I'm asking, I suppose, much more. Let's just look at short term politics for a second. As you say, it's multi level. So give me some of the levels. Okay. Give me some grasp of it.
Well, the first level is specific to the Tory party. That while you can debate about the influence of climate skeptics in British politics, it's not the same as in America. All the climate skeptics who are in British politics are in the Tory party. So they do have a kind of a lunatic fringe that they have to make deals with and that they have to kind of keep you know, keep happy. And so right. there was a period, after all, when the climate skeptic was actually the environment minister under David Cameron's government. So, you know, they do have that they have to manage. And so it's difficult for a Tory government to do anything more than make noises about green issues.
I mean,
when Cameron was doing that, when he was going for election for the first time, that was because they were trying to appeal to kind of the soft right, and that was the political positioning.
Right.
So there's that
right.
issue.
Okay.
The second one is a more fundamental one, that I think the experience of trying to create carbon markets, trying to use the mechanism of the market to address emissions, has really shown that you can't. It's it's proved very, very difficult to actually get a mechanism that enables people to make money and change to more environmentally friendly electricity generation or whatever it is.
Right.
It really hasn't worked on, you know, on a carbon trading level, or actually on just a kind of trying to encourage electricity companies to build wind farms and so on. It really hasn't taken off, and I think there's the problem. I mean, obviously it's proved quite difficult to get people to build new nuclear power stations as well, but. The first level is specific to the Tory party, that while you can debate about the influence of climate sceptics in British politics, it's not the same as in America. All the climate sceptics who are in British politics are in the Tory party. So they do have a kind of a lunatic fringe that they have to make deals with, and that they have to kind of keep, you know, keep happy. And so there was a period, after all, when the climate sceptic was actually the environment minister under David Cameron's government. So, you know, they do have that they have to manage. And so it's difficult for a Tory government to do anything more than make noises about green issues.
I mean,
when Cameron was doing that, when he was going for election for the first time, that was because they were trying to appeal to kind of the soft right, and that was the political positioning.
Right.
So there's that
right.
issue.
Okay.
The idea that you can just set the market on this and the market will embrace the sort of new environmentally friendly technologies kind of hasn't worked, really. But if you are a government that is wedded to cutting public expenditure, to austerity, to the market is all, then therefore you can't take lots of public money and throw it at it. And that's what it needs. So that's an ideological thing. It's austerity, which is why I think, you know, as I said, that climate change needs to be at the heart of the anti-austerity movement, because it is actually austerity that's standing in the way of some of the major things that we could do right now. So that's another level.
That's a big one.
The sort of level up from that, I think, is that for one thing, I mean, people kind of say, oh, we're all in this together and we all live on one planet, and therefore the elites have just as much interest as in dealing with climate change as the rest of us. And in some senses, that's true, because they also live here. But in other senses, for one thing, environmental disasters can be quite good for capital and for profit. I mean, you only have to look at New Orleans, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that killed a lot of people, displaced a lot of people, and it actually made a lot of people a lot of money. So
which
in a
is
sense,
very sad, but true.
In a sense, therefore, you know, there's a sense in which these things can be opportunities for capital. So, and the other thing, which is, I thought about this first of all when we had those sort of disastrous floods along the Thames a few years ago.
Yeah.
And that was where, you know, because there was flooding in the grounds of Windsor Castle, and people sort of say, oh, even the Queen is affected. And it's a bit like, well, yeah, but she wasn't like going, Philip, take the chairs upstairs. No, she wasn't actually flooded.
Good impression.
You know? But what I was thinking about, well, you know, so, and people did say then, well, surely now the City of London will put pressure on the government to do more about climate change, because it's there, the river that they're next to that's flooding.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, well, what would it actually take for this to disrupt the City of London? They don't have, even if their offices are flooded, they're all backed up in data centres.
Yeah.
No, they can work from home, they've got remote connections, they don't have to care if their receptionist can't get to work, they'll just sack her and get someone else in. You know, they don't. There's actually really very little that the weather can do to them that will really disrupt their operations in a way that would mean that they would want to actually put money that they could otherwise have as profit into dealing with it. So therefore, there's no mechanism for capitalism to deal with that.
Mm.
So there you go. It's my mini-layered answer.
And that's a really, really good answer. I mean, I say it good because you're absolutely right. It's just there. It is compounded by histories, attitudes, ideologies, all which sort of coalesce and create such a solid mass of obstacles that it seems almost impossible. I'm an optimist, so I tend not to think that it is dead and defeated. But here's a word that you said when you were explaining it, care. There was a
I mean, I don't know if Marx ever used the word care, but Heidegger, who's the bane of the philosophical world because of his Nazi affiliations, actually talked a lot about care, and he said a part of our fundamental constitution, this is the bit where I try to keep all his politics out of sight because I don't have any empathy or sympathy for it. There's a failure in him, in his philosophy. But he talked a lot about care. And when I read it in a philosophy book, I thought, care? You know, what does he mean, love? But that's a woolly kind of, you know, religious concept which everyone spouts out and pop songs are on about. That doesn't help.
So that's an ideological thing. It's austerity, which is why I think, you know, they said that climate change needs to be at the heart of the anti-austerity movement, because it is actually austerity that's standing in the way of some of the major things that we could do right now. So that's another level.
That's a big one.
The sort of level up from that, I think, is that for one thing, I mean, people kind of say, oh, we're all in this together and we all live on one planet and therefore the elites have just as much interest in dealing with climate change as the rest of us. And in some senses, that's true, because they also live here.
Care, what does he mean? And he said that he also talked about conscience, having a conscience on an individual level. And I get repeatedly the experience whenever I encounter anything where people finance are to deal with a situation. Now, I don't mean this against anyone who's an accountant. But it's when you're in a position of power to make a decision over people's jobs, not you, but when one is in that position, and the only calculation that counts is the financial one. And it seems to me that when you arrive at that point, something has been lost. And working in education and having encountered that a lot, because the further education sector is sadly riddled with issues of funding, it's riddled with poor management all the way through it, and a tiny little light of, you know, idealism, and we want to make the life better for a handful of, you know, youngsters and so on. I get incredibly hassled by it, because I think it is, for someone who grew up in a religious household who no longer professes a faith in anything like that, but has a very strong, if you like, an instinct for truth, justice and things, which I suspect people who do abandon their religious backgrounds still maintain, maybe they don't, my brother certainly doesn't, that there is a sense that the new priesthood that we genuinely have to usurp and shift out of thing is the financial priesthood. I think the Pope matters to a lot of Catholics. Various imams in Islam matter to the handful of people that they do, and some loony fringe in the Middle East matters to the lunatics who follow them. And Christian fundamentalists have the, and so on. But actually the biggest religious issue we have, because I think this is where capitalism needs, for me, the intellectual unseating, is this priesthood. Yeah, I sit in a room with someone who's arguing with me about people's jobs, in terms of numbers on a spreadsheet, and I try to explain to them you can't calculate it in there because there's a real person behind that, and you can't just chop this number 0.5 and do this to them and do that. Actually, it's a real person. You've got a sense of humor.
Each of us yearns for unity and meaning and justice. We want to connect to our life, to touch the wonder at its root, and to live in a world that is not governed by petty tyrants, be they people or our systems. When it's not there, we can sense its absence. Listening. I'd like to thank Zero Books and Doug Lane for supporting this podcast. For more, go to the Zero Books website or tune in to Zero Squared, the Zero Books podcast with Doug Lane.